You've got as much time to, and I'm going to have you read
All
of your book out loud, too. Okay. So that's the other thing.
Fantastic.
It's a podcast and an audio book.
And I'll read Ulysses also after that.
Yes, okay. The French translation.
I can do it. Good. I can tell already.
They really get that Irish vibe.
Yeah, that's right.
Hello and welcome to The Write-Up with Owen Edgerton. I'm Owen Edgerton, your host for this KUT-produced podcast where we talk to writers about the life they lead and the words they write. Today, we have author, journalist, ghostwriter, Ada Calhoun, and we're going to be talking to her about her latest book, St. Mark's is Dead, The Many Lives of America's Hippest Street. Ada Calhoun grew up there on St. Mark's and has written a fascinating history about three square blocks of New York City, which have influenced American culture and have been a place that has given us music, art, fashion, and countless stories. Thank you for joining us here on The Write-Up, Ada.
Thank you, Owen.
So the book has been getting wonderful reviews. The Village Voice wrote a great piece about it. People are loving it. Are you enjoying all that buzz?
Yeah. I mean, how could... No, I hate it. It's really bad. No, it's amazing. It's totally more than I could ever have hoped for.
Is it more than your... I mean, are you kind of surprised at the amount?
I am. I'm really happy. But I think it's about three blocks in New York City. And so I think part of the anxiety that I had after working on this book for 3 or 4 years was thinking, after all that people will say, it's just, you know, it's just a little piece of New York, and who would care about it outside of New York City? And people do. I think it has resonance. And I think the ideas in the book about who belongs in a place and about gentrification and all those issues are things that almost every city faces.
Yeah. And you were born and raised in St. Mark's.
I was. My parents moved there in 1973. Mm-hmm. So when it was really, really bleak.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of drug use and a lot of homelessness and fires burning in tenements for the insurance money and chaos.
Yeah.
And they thought, you know, what a great place to raise a kid. So I grew up there. I was born in 76.
Mm-hmm. And then you lived there. Well, let me ask you this. Why? Why did you choose to spend so much time and write such a thick book and well-researched book on this particular small street?
I think it started because people kept saying, oh, St. Mark's Place, that used to be cool. It's dead now. And after hearing that for a while and hearing it from people sometimes who had just moved there, I started to get mad because I grew up there and it's my hometown, basically. It's a three-block hometown. And so I started to think, well, you know, I should kind of like defend it a little bit. And then I started researching it and really finding out that the history of it is so rich. I mean, going way back, it was Peter Stuyvesant's Pear Orchard. Then it was a really rich neighborhood. Leon Trotsky worked there. Emma Goldman had a school there. There were gangsters. There were shootouts. It was during Prohibition. There were a bunch of speakeasies. And I mean, on and on and on. W.H. Auden lived there for a long time. The Ramones, New York Dolls. It was so incredible to me. And it had been going on so long. And then also I found that now there are kids still hang out there. It's the same kind of youth culture that's existed for centuries.
Could you read a section?
Sure. I'll just read the introduction.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's read a page. All right. So the introduction. I grew up in Manhattan's East Village. My parents have lived in their three-bedroom top-floor walk-up on St. Mark's Place since 1973. I was born in 1976, an only child. As a little girl in the 80s, I navigated sidewalks cluttered with crack vials, used condoms, and junkies on the nod, and witnessed the Tompkins Square Park riots from my window. As a teenager in the 90s, I bought egg creams at the old-time newspaper shop Gem Spa, and hair dye from the punk shop Manic Panic, rented movies at Kim's Video, and worked the register at St. Mark's Comics. You grew up on St. Mark's Place? People sometimes ask, as if they didn't know children could. Or, you grew up on St. Mark's Place? Implying that I seem too normal to hail from a place with so many mohawks and tattoo parlors. Then, invariably, these strangers will pity me for having missed the street's golden era, which they identify variously as the 1950s, 1960s, or 1970s. They're right. I missed a lot. I did not love in, or be in, or do anything in. I never sat on a trash can outside the Five Spot Jazz Club, listening to Thelonious Monk. I did not see Andy Warhol introduce the Velvet Underground at the Mod Dom. I did not hang out with the Ramones, or the New York Dolls, nor did I see W.H. Auden promenade to church wearing his slippers. much less Peter Stuyvesant stumping down the same lane on his silver and wooden peg leg. "There goes the neighborhood" has been heard on the street in many tongues ever since. Someone is probably saying it right now. A college student told me that St. Mark's Place died just a couple of years ago with the closing of the Cooper Union Starbucks, a business that was initially hailed as the final nail in the street's coffin. As students, James Estrada and his friends lounged there all day free of hassle. "I came back from break," says Estrada, "and it was gone. We used to hang out there and get cups and fill them with strawberry champagne and feel glamorous. There's no room for life to be lived there now. The gentrified are gentrifiers who stuck around."
Ada Calhoun reading from her book, St. Mark's is Dead. So tell me a little bit, why is it? Why is this one road, these three blocks, why has it maintained such a spot for artists, for musicians, for ne'er-do-wells?
People say it's because it's wider than other streets. It's like it's right in the middle of the village. So yeah. I think geographically there's a thing. The sidewalks are wider. It's good for congregating. At one end you have Astor Place, yeah, where you have the subways. And then at the other end you have Tompkins Square Park.
Yeah.
So it's a very nice little street to walk up and down.
And growing up there, like the little moments that you described there, that must have been an amazing place to be, like a child with a sponge brain, just absorbing it all.
I definitely didn't notice it at the time. It just seemed normal to me. And I wrote a story for the New York Times Magazine a couple of years ago about the first time I saw the suburbs. I went to go see my cousins in Ohio, and it blew my mind. I'd never had a root beer float, and I'd never seen a drive-in movie or a kiddie pool or been to a football game or anything. And I came back and my parents said it was very accusatory. Like, you didn't tell me about all of that. So it seemed normal to me at the time. Looking back, it was a wild place to be a little kid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And your parents were making a choice. This wasn't just that, we just happened to land here and not suburbia. They were choosing a more urban setting.
Yes. I mean, they were my mother when I was a kid. My mother was an actress and my father was a writer and poet and then art critic. And so that was where they wanted to be, was in New York. And they thought, we want a city kid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Were books a big part of growing up for you then?
They were. My parents' apartment is packed with too many books, really. They're just piled everywhere and bookshelves kind of overflowing. So I was always a big reader.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember like that first book of yours that you just sort of stumbled across and you're like, oh my God, I want to do this. Jane Eyre.
I remember reading Jane Eyre way too early and I didn't totally understand it
yeah.
because I was too young to really be reading it, but I liked the feeling of people seeing me reading it. and then I liked the way it sounded and I got pretty excited about that.
Yeah. My daughter recently checked out Les Miserables from the library.
Oh, fancy.
Carries it to school every day. I'm like, I think might be a little bit of that. She's 10. And same
yeah,
thing.
Perfect. Like, that's exactly what I was. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's good. You should encourage that.
I most certainly do.
Aspirational reading.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Sometimes holding a book is a big part of loving
definitely.
A book. Yeah. A lot of St. Mark's has, the history of St. Mark's has been weaved with music. Even in your introduction, you talk about Thelonious Monk and the Ramones and, of course, the Beastie Boys.
Yep.
It just seems like decade to decade, some of the best creative musicians were there. Why is that? Is that something that are those musicians sort of aware of that, or do they congregate there because like, oh great, I'm walking into history, or is it more just because the clubs are there?
Well, it was the commercial strip. So I guess if we go back to the earliest one in the 50s, there were a couple of jazz clubs on the street. There was the Jazz Gallery, and then there was the Five Spot starting in 64, I guess.
Yeah.
It was around the corner, and then it moved right onto St. Mark's Place. So I think it started out for jazz, and then I think it just kind of continued because there were all these theaters there and clubs and bars, and it was just where people went to meet up with each other.
Yeah.
And so the musicians would be there and would perform and would, sit on stoops.
Yeah.
And Adam Horovitz told me about writing Paul Revere on the steps of St. Mark's Sound, which is at number 20 St. Mark's Place.
That's cool.
Yeah.
So as a teenager, were you like frequenting those places? Were you checking out the music scene yourself?
I was. And of course, I was a teenager in the 90s, so it was a big time for zine culture.
Mm.
And so I definitely read all the fanzines and all that. I would get them at St. Mark's Books.
Oh, that's great. And yeah. St. Mark's Books is still there.
It just moved to 3rd Street.
It did, okay.
Yeah, so it they lost their lease at Cooper.
Well, St. Mark's is dead.
It's dead, again. For real this time, totally, yeah.
I love, actually, what you were saying about how many times a place is declared dead or not cool or the golden age has passed. Mm-hmm. In Austin, where we are now, at the KUT studios, while you're listening to The Write-Up with Owen Edgerton, COI.
That
put that in
slick.
There. Slick. But Austin is famous. People, I think, stay around in Austin. Like, oh, have I lived here a decade? Now I can officially complain and tell people it was cooler when you didn't live here.
Right.
And that comes around again and again. I wonder if that is just a trait of living in a vibrant community, that as a community changes, people are going to be reminiscent about the time when they first found the place.
I think so. And I think what they're missing a lot of times is being young. So I had an op-ed in the New York Times a few days ago that was basically about that experience people have of missing as the city they knew and that they loved and feeling like the city's left them and it's not cool anymore or interesting anymore. And what I heard in doing like 200 interviews for this book was people would name the time when it was actually really cool. And it wasn't the same time. It wasn't like there was an objective golden moment in 1977 or 64 or 55. It was always when the person had been their hottest. So it was like when they were 19.
Yeah.
And then it was like that was when the city was good. And I started to think maybe it has something to do with the fact that they were young and excited and just discovering the city for the first time. And now that they're not all those things, they are declaring it over.
You know, that makes a lot of sense. And that might be why I continue to love Austin so much, because I...
Because you're still young and
hot.
Handsome.
I'm continually hot.
That's right.
I mean, it's, you know, to tell you the truth, it's troubling.
Yeah, it's a burden. It's a burden. I'm sure, I can tell.
Yeah, yeah. I have to deal with that on a daily basis. That's why I do radio, actually, because, you know, people can't see me. If you could, though, if I had a time machine made out of a fancy car from a company that went out of business, if I had one of those and I was able to take you to one time, one year in St. Mark's that you would love to just visit, not to say this was a high point or the golden age, what would be that for you?
Well, I guess the person that I fell in love with most while I was working on the book was W.H. Auden. So maybe in the like late 60s to go hang out with him and have martinis at his apartment.
Tell me about that, about falling in love with Auden.
Well, I'd always really loved his writing, but then the more stories I heard about him, the more I just thought, what a saint. I mean, there was one story where he was asked if he would marry someone's daughter to rescue her from the Nazis, basically. Mm-hmm. And it was a pretty big ask, and other mutual friends had already turned this guy down. And W.H. Auden wrote back a telegram with one word on it that said, delighted. And he did it. He married her and saved her.
Wow.
Yeah. He just did these things for people all the time. He found ways to pay for friends' surgeries without them knowing. He just did all of these little acts of extreme generosity and magic that and just didn't want credit for them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So having a couple of martinis with Auden.
Yeah. Can't beat that.
No, I suppose that would be it. You grew up and you talk about how St. Mark's definitely has a danger aspect to it. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily as safe as the suburbs where too many root beers might be the greatest danger.
Right.
And now you're a mother yourself.
I am. My son's 9.
9. And you live in Brooklyn, is that right?
Oh, in Williamsburg.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. I've heard of that.
How do you?
Now, what do you think now? Now that you're a mother yourself, how do you feel about the parenting decision to have a kid running around with, you know, crack?
They did their best. That's how I feel. They
yeah.
did it, you know, and I think that everything's a trade-off, right? And,
yeah.
And I had a very sophisticated childhood. I grew up real fast, and there are advantages to that, just like there are disadvantages. So, you know, my son and his friends are growing up in a much safer city, and I'm happy because I don't have to fret quite as much as I'm sure my parents did. But yeah, I mean, I definitely see like teenagers leave their laptops on and at restaurants on counters. And I'm like, oh, because for me, it's still the 80s. And
do you steal them just to teach them a lesson?
I always have like a flicker of like wanting to do or just like to show them. But of course, you know, what am I going to teach them? What it was like 20 years ago? They don't need to know that.
Of course they do. That's why they're going to read your book. And then, Let's talk about that trade-off, though. I always find it fascinating. I'm a parent as well, and fascinating of how writers specifically introduce the world to their kids, mm-hmm. and that desire to simultaneously expose your kids to the wonders and the arts and the edges of society, but also protect your kids,
uh-huh.
and finding where that balance is.
Right.
So how do you do that? How do you navigate that?
You know, my kid loves museums and he loves adventure. So we just, you know, we travel a lot and I really like to just bring him around to stuff.
Yeah.
You know, we go to the Natural History Museum like probably every other week.
Oh,
and
yeah.
The Met a lot. And he knows the city so well. And so that gives me a feeling of safety, just that he feels so at home and so comfortable and he knows the subways and he knows the neighbors. And I think there's security in that for me.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that, for sure. Let's talk about St. Mark's is Dead. When did you start working on it?
I was at the New York Post crime desk,
yeah.
Just freelance reporting for them, and was trying to think of a new book idea, and I just started thinking about the street and people's reactions to it, and that was in 2011.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't really do that much with the idea for a few months, so 3 or 4 years, depending on how you count it.
Sure. And when you were working, did you continue working there and then stop in the process of writing the book, or?
Well, I do a lot of things all at once.
Sure.
I can't really focus on one thing at a time.
Yeah, yeah.
So I ghost wrote like 5 other books while I was doing this one. And then I also did a couple of fellowships for like, you know, national news reporting.
Get out.
Yeah.
When do you rest?
And I taught.
And you taught?
I taught it. Well, just for like a semester. I taught public affairs reporting at Hofstra.
Oh, all right. That's great. And you have a kid.
I do have a kid.
Right. So you do quite a bit.
Yeah. I don't like being bored.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I don't think, it doesn't sound like you give yourself half a chance.
No.
Well, with this one then, when you're writing it, and did it seem like, it seems like a work of passion.
It was, yeah.
And I know as a writer myself, there are different projects that sometimes you're like, oh, I've got a deadline, I have to
right.
finish this. And then one's like, oh, I'm working on this more than anyone's asking
yes,
me to work on it.
Definitely. No, and I did. And I just did... every interview I did, the person would tell me about 5 other people. And so it just kept snowballing. And I, you know, in between other work I had, it was like, I felt like I was cheating on my other work with this book because it was all I really could think about. And I would just do a couple of interviews every chance I got. And so I wound up doing like between 200 and 250 interviews for the book.
Wow. Tell me about some of those people. You talked about Auden and discovering more about who he was. Mm. Who are the other people that you've met while strolling down St. Mark's?
Well, I guess one of the characters from the past who I was really excited about is this guy named Mr. Zero. And during the Depression, he fed and clothed thousands of homeless people on St. Mark's Place. He had a series of shelters, including what he called the Tub. And he was just this remarkable showman. Like, he just made sure everybody knew, and he had this whole this Mr. Zero alter ego, and he was a real hustler. And by the time he left, around when the New Deal came in, he was like, okay, my work is done here, and left, went off to like some island with his like vixen wife. And he left like in millions of dollars of debt. Like, he was like, so I call him the original St. Mark's Place hustler.
Uh-huh.
There have been many over the years.
Yeah.
But I feel like he was the first one, and I was able to find a book he wrote and self-published that I sort of dug it out of the library. It's amazing. It's all this really obscure mysticism and like 1,000 pictures of him. And it's a very cool book. And when I found it, I got very excited.
Wow. Yes.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. Are there quotes from that book?
There are.
Oh.
Yeah.
I love that. So how about some of the ones more recently?
Oh, so that was one of the most fun things, was just walking down the street, and I would just stop people sometimes. There were people who were sitting out on the stoop all the time, and I would see them over and over. And I just sort of got in the habit of talking to everybody in different shops. And I, you know, I had this book party at Cooper Union the day the book came out. And I think 700 people came, and it was a lot of people who hadn't seen each other in years and years. People like who had been friends in the 60s or in the 70s or in the 80s. And I just kept hearing all these great stories the days after that about how they met back up and got back in each other's lives. And it was really exciting because I think that there, because it's this youth culture, You know, there were people like this woman I met who has a photo in the book. She used to go to the shop Christina Gorby all the time, which was like a famous 60s fashion shop on St. Mark's Place. And it meant so much to her. And she had this outfit that that she had loved for many years. It was like her favorite thing in the world. And then at the party, she ran into Christina Gorby because Christina Gorby came to her and was like, I made that outfit. And they hadn't seen each other since 1970.
Wow.
So I just, they're still around, all these people
who
are important to the life of the street at various points. And it's been really fun to get to know them.
What is St. Mark's like now, today?
There are still kids there. I mean, it's still definitely a place for drunk teenagers, as it has been for many years. There are a lot of Japanese and Korean restaurants, and there are karaoke places. So the food is way better than I think it's been in a long time, because you have bao and ramen and all these great things, yakitori. So that's what it's mainly known for, I guess. There aren't clubs there anymore. But, you know, it's funny, like, you go to the karaoke places and it's a lot of the same bands that played there originally now are represented by the karaoke machine.
That's a bit different. So, and it's hard to do karaoke to Thelonious Monk. I've tried that.
Have you? I want to see that.
Would you? Okay.
I need video, post video.
You know, I find it, what you're saying about the community of folks that have come together for your book release party. And I've always fascinated when a place is able to be a fostering of community, and people are kind of slamming into each other with ideas and inspiring one another. And what's one of the things I love about Austin, it's definitely one of the things I love, like when you read about San Francisco of the 1950s and Paris in the 1920s.
Right.
I wonder, that community, what are some of the fruits that we've seen in the American culture? Like, it's the hippest street in the most influential city in America. How have we been impacted by what's happened there?
Well, I mean, it's, depending on who you ask, it's basically, it started everything. So preschool, stonewashed jeans, punk, new wave, no wave. There's
all started at St. Mark's.
You can find somebody who will argue for an address on St. Mark's Place, you know, generating just about anything. These microphones, probably somebody would be like, yes, of course, at number 13. And so, you know, it's hard to separate the mythology from the actuality. I think it's definitely true that New York School of Poetry was largely centered on and around St. Mark's Place. Oh. The St. Mark's Poetry Project has given us a ton of literature over the years. Theater Genesis really helped the career of Sam Shepard. Mm-hmm. Punk rock, this is where everybody hung out. I mean, they were at CBGB's a couple blocks away at night, and during the day they were at Manic Panic on St. Mark's Place. So New York Dolls posed on the street in front of Gem Spa for their important album. The Ramones, and Television, all these different groups really hung out there, and a lot came out of it.
We're talking to Ada Calhoun about her new book, St. Mark's is Dead. I'm fascinated by what you're talking about, and it seems that this book, which is a beautiful book, also physically, I love the cover. Remember when I first saw that cover, I was like, "Oh, gosh!"
Good.
And it talking to you, it seems it's so many stories are contained not only within these three city blocks, but within this book. That there, if you just take a slight turn, you're gonna there's another book, and there's another book.
Yeah.
I wonder how you found a way to. to narrow the focus, and are you going to find that, oh, my next book is Auden, my next book is Mr. Zero, my next book is a history of the Ramones. Are you finding that this is the beginning of something?
I don't know what the spinoff series is. I don't know where the Joni Loves Chachi is in this book. I think the next book, actually, I already have figured out, and it's not related to New York history. But, you know, I kind of like just telling the best, most exciting story from each period. I like mixtapes, and I like greatest hits albums, and I feel like that's what I wanted to make with this.
Let's talk a little bit, if you're okay with about your career.
Sure.
So you've been writing for your entire career.
Yep.
Yeah. And naturally, you lived here in Austin, Texas. You wrote the Austin Chronicle.
That's right. That's where I started. Thank you, Austin Chronicle.
Yeah, we love the Austin Chronicle.
Yeah.
And the... and you continue to write, and you have written in all kinds of ways. You've been a reporter and a journalist, the crime reporter mm-hmm. for the New York Post. How did you start doing that, and what was that experience like?
It was fantastic. There is no better job, as
really?
Far as I'm concerned. It's really exciting.
Yeah, but is it terrifying too?
I don't know. It's really.
I'm scared.
Are you scared?
I'm a little scared.
Okay, well, I'll try to.
No, know, it's a good scare.
It.
No, scare me. I'm okay.
Yeah, no, I had been doing a lot of like arts reporting and culture coverage and that kind of thing, and I liked it, but it also started to feel a little frivolous to me, and it started to feel like maybe a lot of it felt the same. It wasn't exciting so much. And then I saw that they were hiring at the New York Post for reporters, and I went over there, and I just really loved being in a newsroom. I never had been in a newsroom. I'd been at magazines like weeklies and monthlies, mm-hmm. And then suddenly to be in a daily
right.
reporting atmosphere, I just loved it. It was really exhilarating for me. And yeah, it was creepy and maudlin sometimes because you get there and someone would say, oh, this guy just jumped off a building. See if you can find his girlfriend. Creepy, but really never boring.
Yeah, I'm sure never boring.
Yeah.
And then how long did you stay doing that as...
Not very long. I was doing it for, I guess, like a year,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I was doing other stuff at the same time. And then kind of in between ghostwriting books, I'd be there.
Let's talk about the ghostwriting books.
Sure.
So what like, how did you get into that? And what kind of genre of books are you ghostwriting?
My agent at the time, I'd been working on this, you know, other project. And then my agent said, you know, I have this other client, Tim Gunn, who's looking for help with this book he's working on. Would you like to meet with him? And I was a big Project Runway fan. So I was like, are you kidding? Do I want to hang out with Tim Gunn? Yes, I do. And so I went, and we got along really well right away. And he hired me to help him with the book. That wasn't a ghost project because he's the nicest man in the world. And he put my name on the front, mm-hmm. and it was a bestseller. So that helped me get other books in the future. I've done three with him now, and then I guess another five or so for other people, and they've been, one was food, one was personal finance, you know, one was business, it's been kind of across the board. I like variety.
Do you enjoy the process?
It can be really fun.
Yeah,
it depends a lot on who you're helping, and you know, I think all the best ones and the last ones have been just great. It's people who I just really enjoy, and I want to help them tell their story. Like, I think what they have to say is really interesting and fun, and I just want to facilitate.
You seem to be you find stories in people that you I can tell by talking to you that you are someone who seeks out people. Is that usually your way in to a story or a piece? Is it a person or is it an experience?
Well, if it's essays, usually it's experiences, but yeah, if I'm reporting a story, I want to find the person mm-hmm. who is involved in it, and then I want to find all the other people who are involved in various ways and talk to them all. And I really like I don't like advocacy journalism. Mm-hmm. I don't like really arguing for things or manifestos. I like the stories and the nuance in it, and I like to be surprised, and I always am surprised.
What are you researching now? What is a thing that's exciting you?
Well, I had this modern love story for the New York Times called The Wedding Toast I'll Never Give.
Mm-hmm.
And the response to that was really surprising.
Yes,
and
yeah.
big and great. And so my editor, who on St. Mark's Is Dead, this guy, Tom Mayer, who's incredible, he asked me to do a book based on that essay. So that's what I'm working on right now. So I'm talking to everybody about their marriages. So we can now segue into you telling me all about your marriage.
It's very good, Jody, if you're listening. Really A-class, really A-class wedding, marriage and stuff.
Fair enough.
I say that every night. Hey, good day today.
Good day.
Good day.
High five.
B+.
Yeah.
We're doing great. We're talking to Ada Calhoun about her career as a writer, the book she's working on now, and her latest book, St. Mark's Is Dead, which is just out. And we're talking to her in KUT's The Write-Up. So with the reaction that's becoming from this book, have there been any pushbacks? Any people like, who have said, oh, you got this wrong. You don't get St. Mark's in the way it should be.
You know, I kind of thought there'd be more.
Yeah.
I mean, and of course, it's early. People haven't had time to read it and get mad and yell at me or throw things at my house. But I think the only person who's in the book so far who I've really heard from was this this woman who ran a rehab center on the street for years. And she shows up in the book at various points. She's been kind of a fixture on the street. She was in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. And I tracked her down in Albany. She hadn't kind of been heard from in the New York scene for a long time. And I found her. And I spent a lot of time with her. And she had a problem with one word, which was that I had referred to her as this guy's mistress. And I was like, was he not married to his wife still? And I was like, because that would be a huge mistake. And she was like, well, they'd been separated for a while, and I just would have preferred soulmate. So if everybody could just go into your book, go find the word mistress, cross it out, and write soulmate. And then we're all, then there's no complaints.
That's the only one. That's very good. I was going to actually ask you, what would you say is like the biggest scandal in the history of St. Mark's? What's the biggest scandal?
Oh, gosh. Like... with money or sex or what kind? There's
If you can find one with money, sex, and violence, I'd prefer that.
Money, sex, and violence is a pretty tall order. Mm. There were a lot of speakeasies, I would say, gangsters and speakeasies. And there's a character in the book named Dopey Benny Fine, who
say that name again.
His name was Dopey Benny Fine.
Oh,
and he was one of a group of Jewish gangsters who really were very intimidating. And Dopey Benny really liked the unions, the sort of new unions coming in. So unlike a lot of the gangsters, he would not bring about hits and things on everyone, just on bosses. So he was kind of, you know, like Robin Hood-ish kind of gangster. But he tried to have this assassination at this nightclub, or, you know, this community hall slash party place on St. Mark's Place, and failed. And the only person who died was like a passerby. And then it really brought the full wrath of the NYPD. It was a city employee, unfortunately, for him. Mm. And so it brought the wrath of the city government down on him. And
down
really
on Dopey.
And down on Dopey, and really kind of ended the gangster reign in that part of the city.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, how about that?
There's no sex in that. I'm sorry.
There probably was.
I'm sure. In the nightclub, you can imagine all kind of filthy things happening.
The pastor was doing something. It seems that with a lot of these stories that you're talking about, we have people who are setting up homeless shelters but are also leaving millions of dollars in debt because they're con men, and people who are helping with rehab on the street situations but are also...
soulmates.
Soulmates with possibly married people. And then gangsters that are kind of Robin Hood. Did you find a lot of that, that there was a, oh gosh, what would you say, a complicated characters?
Yeah, a lot of complexities. And that's, I mean, how much more fun is that than if everybody was like, you know, either demons or saints?
Right. But that also happens to be, it seems, the way you look into it, that you find someone who could, any one of these characters could have been described simply as a gangster or simply as a saint. But you are attracted to that
nuance, I guess. And I mean, and that's one thing about the way people talk about cities, definitely have talked about St. Mark's Place, talk about Austin, that I really don't like, is where it's all good or all bad.
Right.
It was all good in 1969. It's all bad now. It was all good in 1974. And, you know, I just, that to me is not, it's not right. And it's not helpful.
Do you find that same philosophy goes into your exploration of marriages?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think that, so the Wedding Toast story was basically just about this experience of being mad at my husband over something, and going through that whole process of being full of anger and rage and just ultimately coming out with this sense of like, that's part of it. Like being married, I think people sometimes think is going to lead to all this happiness, but it's so much more complicated, and that's like better and worse at the same time. It's like, it gives you meaning, I think, and beauty and all these wonderful things. At the same time, it makes you, you know, want to run screaming into the night. So I think those two things, you can't really have either one alone.
Yeah. I wonder, with writing about your own marriage, as a reporter, you are not writing about yourself at all. You're distant. As a ghostwriter, you know, your name is not even on the subject.
Right.
With St. Mark's, you're writing about a place where you grew up, but you're writing about the history of that place. And this, as you're talking about marriage, well, this is getting more and more personal. Where do you find the writing for you gets the closest to the personal, the closest to, here's what my soul is?
Well, I mean, I really like other people's stories. I'm really curious about other people. And then I feel like when I write essays, it's because there's something specific I want to say, and I use myself as an example because that's just my point of departure.
Sure.
But usually when I'm writing essays, they can be very personal and revealing and too much information, but they're not about confessing to things. It's really about trying to share something and make a point and maybe make people feel less alone in certain experiences.
Mm, yeah. Making people feel less alone is something, there's that quote that we read to know we're not alone.
Mm-hmm. I like that. I think that's true. And I feel like when I, anything I'm writing, I like the idea that somebody would read it, now or after I'm dead or whenever, and have that experience of some kind of connection the way that I do when I read. Yeah. Read books.
We're talking to Ada Calhoun about her book, St. Mark's is Dead. This is KUT's podcast, The Write-Up with Owen Edgerton. And by coincidence, I'm Owen Edgerton. I'm wondering, in the writing of St. Mark's is Dead, what was the biggest surprise? You already knew the place. You already had a working understanding of the history of St. Mark's. What was there anything in there that shocked you?
Oh, gosh, what did shock me? Oh, that it was rich in the 1830s, that it was incredibly fancy. I think there's this narrative that I'd always been fed that it started out sort of rural and humble and then worked its way up and sort of middle class, and then it was poor, and then now it's super rich, and how ridiculous. It's not supposed to be that way. But it was rich before it was poor. And I think so the surprise for me has just been that the narrative isn't real, or it's only partial. And like people were always saying like, oh, it used to be so great when people didn't have to work all the time and they could have a loft in Soho or a huge apartment on St. Mark's Place for $100 a month. And they had only had to like work at a bookstore 2 days a week. And that was when you really could have art. That was when you could have real music as opposed to this that's on the radio now. And it's just not true. It's just like there have been 20 years throughout history where I feel like people didn't have to work that hard, and it was because nobody wanted to live here. And so you could have a place really cheap. Mm-hmm. And that was, in the 60s and 70s. And it's like, that was an exception.
Right.
So my friends and I, we work really hard and we still find a way to do the stuff we want to do just the same way people did in the 50s and in the 40s and in the, 1790s and in all the other periods of time. So, that was, in a way, it was actually kind of a relief to me because people had been like, oh, wouldn't it be great? Like, wouldn't there be so much more art if it was 1977 and tenements were burning around us? I don't know. I don't know if it would be great.
When you put it like that. I think that's a great thing, a great myth to expose. I'm rereading some of the letters of Ginsberg and Kerouac that they write to each other. And as Howl is being published, as the success of that is happening, Ginsberg is working as a merchant marine and struggling for money.
Yeah.
And Kerouac's like, well, yeah, On the Road's coming out. Could you send me $20, please?
Yeah.
It's
like we're all human beings and we all have to find a way to make a living and do the stuff we want to do. And it's always been that way. So.
Right.
Yeah.
If you do discover a place where I don't have to make money.
I'll let you know.
Would you?
We can get in a time machine and go back to...
Luckily, I'm into public radio and ka-ching.
Ka-ching, yeah.
I just make it
You're
rain.
You're rolling in it.
It's crazy. Yep. We have got these new Grackle socks that we get for KUT. It's fantastic.
Oh.
That was our big giveaway this year.
Or do you still have some? I want some.
I don't... We'll have to find out.
I like Grackles.
Yeah, and the socks are nice too. It's hard to get the socks onto the Grackles because they have those those little pointy feet.
Yeah, the claws.
Let me ask you this. Writing this book, I as a writer find that anytime I write a book, something has changed. I go into it in one way and I come out a slightly different person. How has writing St. Mark's is Dead changed you as a writer and as a person?
It made me think a lot deeper about things. I think because I was used to doing, monthly, weekly, and then daily writing, I was used to being on deadline and just churning stuff out. I was fine with that. I was kind of proud of it. Like I could just knock stuff out all the time. This book was not like that. And my editor on this was harder than any editor I've ever worked with. He was really ruthless with the manuscript. Made me rewrite the thing we were trying to count the other day, like five times. I don't know. I rewrote the whole thing multiple times. And it was like going to graduate school or something. I became a much better writer and a much, I think I just started thinking more deeply about things. Not to brag, but like, you know, I feel like I became a more serious person.
Mm. So the next book is going to be about marriage. Do you see what's going to be coming next?
Really? You're going to ask me? I was feeling pretty smug because I was like, people are like, I know you probably don't want to answer this question, but what's the next book? And I'm like, I got it covered. Marriage. Yeah, no, I have no idea after that.
All right, fair enough. That was a horrible question.
I'll get right on it though.
Good. I'll expect an answer about that and also the place I can go and not work.
That's right. Okay, I've got it on my notebook. So.
Great. Yeah. This has been The Write-Up with Owen Edgerton, a KUT-produced podcast where we talk to writers about the words they write and the life they lead. We've been talking to Ada Calhoun about her new book, St. Mark's is Dead, The Many Lives of America's Hippest Street. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I didn't say that before. Congratulations
so
on
much.
The book. And thank you so much for spending some time.
It's a real pleasure. You're great. It was really fun.
Well, thank you. And thank you guys for listening to The Write-Up. As always, we record here in the beautiful KUT studios. Our producer is Rebecca McEnroy. David Alvarez was our engineer. And I am Owen Edgerton. Keep reading, keep talking to people who read books, and keep listening to podcasts put out by KUT. I think that's all I can ask of anyone.